2011. And sometimes, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to introduce my guest. That's what I don't usually do that, but I'm going to, it's so different today, I'm going to spend the introduction introducing my guest. Sometimes I read Jeffrey Goldberg over at the Atlantic Magazine. It's online, it's free. But a lot of you have probably never heard of Jeffrey Goldberg. Some people have, though. Some people have. Last year, when Castro wanted to tell the world what he thought about going to war with Iran over those nukes, over their nuclear power aims, he invited Jeffrey Goldberg to come down to Cuba, have a little conversation. So Jeffrey Goldberg is pretty famous. And about a month ago, I was reading Jeffrey Goldberg, and he had an interview with a guy named William Kohlbrenner, K-O-L-B-R-E-N-E-R. Billy Kohlbrenner, he's an English professor who wrote a religious book called Open-Minded Torah. Now, that's an intriguing title because in case you don't know it, and I assume you don't, the Torah is the Bible. It's the first five books of the Bible. But in my understanding, it can mean all of the Old Testament. So you know what the Bible's full of. It's full of God telling you what to do and how he's going to kill you or hurt you if you don't do that. So you have to figure that anybody who believes in the Bible is not going to be open-minded because he thinks he knows what God wants. But Billy says that's not true. His great-grandfather, Velvel, his name was Velvel, I think it means wolf, was not only the most religious man in town, he was also the most open-minded. So I enjoyed that interview, and when I see someone interesting online, I check to see if they're on Twitter. I did that with Billy, and I followed him. And to my surprise, he followed me back. So I sent him a DM, a direct message. I said, look, Billy, I don't think you should follow me. I'm a headhunter. I post lots and lots of stuff that has nothing to do with you. But if you like, I said, you can come on my show. So he wrote back immediately, and he said, sure, I'll come on your show. So I said, well, look, I really didn't mean it. I was only being polite. And he said, look, animal, I got books to sell. I want to come on that show. So I said, look, there's a lot of yelling on my show. It's not for you. He said, you think yelling bothers me? I've got seven kids. Seven kids. So anyway, I couldn't get rid of the guy. So I figured, okay, if I interview someone who was also interviewed by Jeffrey Goldberg, remember him? Maybe it's going to be good for my brand. So today's show is not about recruiting. It's not about your career. And if you think that's going to make you mad, go away! Switch the show off! Go listen to Drive Through HR. Drive Through HR features Billy Tincup and Brian Wempen, and lots of a half hour of exciting conversation. Actually, it's not on right now. It's on at 1 o'clock. But anyway, here on this show, we're going to talk about something else. I don't know what, but I know what show it is. Jerry, Jerry! Can you tell me, Jerry, what show is it?
The Recruiting Animal Show!
Other stuff on my list of clips that I couldn't find it. Billy Kohlbrenner, the guest, did you show up? Are you there? Bill, speak now. You know, he called me a few minutes ago. Oh, here he is. Let's see. Billy, are you there?
I'm here. I'm online.
Okay. The guest called me like 5 minutes before the show at my office and said, okay, I'll just stay on hold. I said, didn't I give you another number? But he called this one. I'm kind of worried, Bill, about what that means. But anyway, let's proceed.
I'm here now, Animal. I have to tell you that I haven't been called Billy since I think about the seventh grade, so I'm really, really grateful for that.
Okay, well, I'm glad you're grateful, because as everyone's going to see, one of your big shticks is about how we're all vulnerable, and I believe that people hide behind adult names. They're afraid to face the fact that they're the same people they were when they were children. There's nothing wrong with Billy. I read about it in your book.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, look, I got to tell you, I'm sticking my neck out by having you here talking about religion. Can be very bad for my brand, because let's say some big network executive wants to put my show on TV, and then someone shows them this show, and I said something about Moses or Abraham or someone, and they say, look what the Animal said about religion. This is going to cause a scandal. It's too hot for TV.
Well,
I can get screwed. They want me to come crawling.
Not to scandalize you or your audience.
Okay.
Sounds like
I just
a great
want
show,
you to know,
actually.
I'm kind of a hero just for having you here, okay?
You're my hero so far. Let's see how things go.
I'm glad. How about talking into the phone? I know you got a landline and you're not on a headset, but I'm still having a bit of trouble hearing.
I'm doing my best here. Is this working
That's
for you?
That's better
no,
for
I
me.
I can hear him.
That's better for me. That's Janice.
Hi, Janice.
Thank you.
Hi,
okay. Now, anyway, Bill, I have to put you to the side for a second. I got some social media scores to settle. Last week, I told people that if they want to suck up to someone influential on social media, they can give them clout over and over again. They go to clout.com and they give K. So yesterday I got an email from regular listener Lil Brenda. She says, I gave lots of K this week and I got no results. I get better results doing RTs. Okay, I never said RTs weren't good, but if you want to suck up to someone who's famous and popular, maybe you got to give them K every week until they notice you, okay? It doesn't happen overnight. Issue number two, the Fordyce letter. The editor was the guest last week, Amy Beth Hale. Their picture on Twitter includes the whole three words, the Fordyce letter. Imagine how big that turns out to be on a 1/4-inch square on Twitter in the stream. You can't see it at all. So I told her, Amy Beth, just use a big F. And then my shadow, the resume strategy, has to pipe in. She says, because nothing says success like a great big F as your brand. Don't listen to him. Well, you should listen to me. And if you look at the pictures on this show's listing on Blog Talk Radio, I put that F in there, and it's very good. Don't listen to her, Amy Beth. I know what I'm talking about. Okay, Billy, back to you. Okay?
Animal. Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, now, I don't know, I'm not really interested in the religious part of what you have to say. I'm more interested in the psychology, but, you know, we're going to have to talk about it sooner or later. So you told a story that you came from a fairly secular household and you got religion when you started snooping around one of your professors in university. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Animal, I'm not crazy about the term religious because it has all these connotations, all these meanings that I don't necessarily like to drag along long. Because for me, being religious is not really just a kind of, you know, spiritual endeavor. It has a lot to do with the practical, which I hope in some sense will resonate with your listeners in some of the conventional terms in which they're interested. But yeah, my wife and I were at Columbia, and we had a professor of modern literature, and one Saturday morning we stalked him. Now, there were these traditions, there were these Spanish Jews called Marranos, and they were secret Jews, and my professor was one of these secret Jews. We followed him down to a synagogue on the Upper West Side, and we figured if he was interested in embracing this life of Jewish learning and Jewish practice, it might be something that we would be willing to explore as well. And I have to tell you, it was not an easy thing to take on because I had a pretty good reputation in the department. I was in the Department of English Literature, and I kind of hear your skepticism and your cynicism, and, you know, I was coming from exactly the same place. And when my friend saw me putting on a skull cap one Monday morning, and when I didn't show up to the West End bar one Friday night, people started whispering about me in the hallways. You know, I mean, I started hearing, you told me I'm not allowed to curse, Animal, but I started hearing the F word, which was not...
Fordyce letter?
Pardon?
Fordyce letter?
Well, the F word in this case was fundamentalist.
Okay.
And really, that's kind of, you know, that, I really had to bear that in graduate school. I mean, the worst thing you could be in a multicultural liberal English department in the 1980s was somebody who looked like an Orthodox Jew, and that's what I was becoming. So I started to hear this fundamentalist term, this F word, all the time. And notwithstanding all the other stuff that I was doing, and I had a good rep in the department, they started whispering, you know, well, what's wrong with Kohlbrenner? You know, what had happened to me? I mean, it's an interesting sociology, which you might find interesting. I mean, everybody in the department was Jewish, and you could be any number of different things in the English department. You could be a Marxist or a psychoanalyst or a feminist or a deconstructionist, but to be somebody who was Jewish, that was beyond the pale. So, yeah, that's what happened.
Okay.
I find it interesting.
Okay. Is that Janice again?
Yeah.
ExecJobCoach.com? Okay, fine. Janice, we'll give you lots of opportunity to ask Billy questions. First, I have to get a message from one of our sponsors, JobSpeak.com. JobSpeek.com. JobSpeak is a free mobile job posting app. It's a free mobile job posting app. You post a job from your smartphone to the internet, and it lets you post a picture of your business and a 60-second audio about the job directly from your phone. And it cross-posts it to your Facebook and Twitter accounts automatically, and it's brought to you by Chris Russell, the genius behind AllCountyJobs.com. Remember them? So that's JobSpeak. JobSpeak.com. Billy, can you say that with me, JobSpeak.com?
I think, Animal, I can say JobSpeak if you can say Bill. Bill.
Bill, I can't. I like Billy, and I just like your friend who looked you up on Facebook or wherever, and he said, is this Billy Kohlbrenner? Okay, so you're Billy to me. Okay, so JobSpeak.com. Now, Billy, one of your big things here is I read your book. I downloaded it on Kindle. I just have to tell everybody, I couldn't get it at a local bookstore in hard copy for $23, so I downloaded this free Kindle software from Amazon, and then I was able to buy the book for $10, and boom, I had it right in front of me on my computer. I can search any keywords, and I can also highlight stuff. And I highlighted everything. Mind you, the more you highlight, the longer it takes to highlight later on. But it's great. I really like it. I recommend it highly, and I don't have to find a place for it on a bookshelf. It's sitting on my hard drive. Okay, Billy, so you talk a lot about internal strength. You want people want to feel secure, but life isn't secure. It often lets us down. You know, there's a big economic problem now. There's lots of wars in the world. And it's only when we fail, however, that we look for some source of internal strength, like someone going to AA after they, you know, have a drinking problem. So this record, but you claim it's the recognition of weakness, our vulnerability, that's actually our key to strength. Once you give up, you know, your hope in having money or being a big shot, you're going to actually find joy. Joy is attained through vulnerability. In fact, you keep banging that drum that you have to give up mastery and take a risk in order to succeed.
I think I don't know. I mean, in my life, even in the academy, in the university, there are a lot of people who are always performing their success. They're always performing their happiness. And I mean, I understand that in certain worlds that has a kind of currency and it's useful. But to me, the people who are performing their strength are in a way admitting, even as they're performing that strength, the kind of vulnerability. My favorite line in all of Shakespeare is, "The lady doth protest too much, methinks." And I think what you said is really, really...
Let me hold on. I don't think people know what you mean by performing their strengths. They're trying to look good. Is that
they're trying
that
to look really
means?
Good. They're trying to look as if they've reached a kind of perfection. And, you know, for the rest of us, sometimes we're intimidated or cowed by that. And I don't know if recognizing suffering is or a vulnerability is the key to joy. I think it's the key to living receptively. It's the key to living with any kind of connection. I also think it's the key to any kind of genuine creativity.
It's the key to challenge.
It's the key to really a kind of openness. Listen, I'm coming from a tradition, as you said. I mean, I learned an enormous amount about my own tradition from your introduction, about the five books of Moses and what people think, people who believe in God must think. And the truth is, you know, there are a lot of mandates to do things. But what really, you know, for me, you use the term being religious. In some sense, being religious means just a kind of openness, a readiness to listen. And when the Jewish people found themselves on Mount Sinai, that's really how they begin to define themselves. way back in, you know, the beginning.
You know what? Nobody in the world would – there's not one person. There's no one in the world who would agree with what you just said, that religion is an openness to listen. I bet you can't find anybody in your neighborhood who agrees with that, and they're all like you.
Which part won't
What do you
agree
mean
with?
By that, an openness? I know you said – you say in your book that you're also interested in psychoanalysis, which isn't that, you know, exposed as a cult, a non-scientific cult back in the 80s already. No one believes it anymore, and that's the other cornerstone of your book. What's with you and psychoanalysis?
I'm not an expert on psychoanalysis, but one of the things that interests me about psychoanalysis, Animal, is that just like Judaism, and I think any serious religious tradition, psychoanalysis recognizes that the person who you are is you alone, and you are individual in that sense. And whatever makes up who you are these individual things that can't be generalized. I mean, we live in a world now of medication and behaviorism, and that stuff is great and it works for a lot of people. But psychoanalysis, and I think a lot like religion, recognizes the individuality of the person. And this parts of me, there's a mystery to the person. There's a mystery to the self. And I think religion helps explore that. And I think, you know, and the psychoanalysis helps explore that. I mean, and one of the things
that really interests me about analysis,
Michael. I'm with you here.
One of the things really interests me about it is that, you know, we have ways all the time of undoing ourselves. You know, I mean, in any kind of context, in a familial context, in a career context. I mean, I have graduate students all the time, and I function more as a psychoanalyst. I imagine as a recruiter, that's what you're doing most of the time. You're trying to figure out why is this person not reaching their goals. That they have stated goals in one hand, and on the other hand, everything they're doing in
That's
their life
is coming
undermined. That's
a career counselor. I'm not a career counselor, Bill. Bill, let me take control of the show. I, you know, there's not many people here to begin with. They're on summer vacation, and
we can talk about whatever we want then.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll have to. First of all, does anybody have any questions so far? Religion, according to this guy, is just keeping an open mind. That's news to me.
Hey, Animal, I didn't say that. I think that's a big
You said it's listening. You said it's listening. And in your book, you said that religious people read the Bible with kind of a free-floating attention, waiting to be surprised, and that the psychoanalysts also have sort of a free-floating attention on whatever their clients are saying, waiting to be surprised. Is that – and now you're saying that's religion. I know
true. Let's go a step at a time. I would say, you know, one of the things that really interests me is someone once said that perversion is thinking you know what you want. I mean, that's a strange definition of perversion.
That's what you said in your book?
Yeah.
That's what you said in your book?
That I already know what I want and I already am where I want to be. Listen, you know, you told me we spoke on the phone about people who can't, you're trying to recruit them and they say, I'm happy where I am. And maybe in some cases that makes sense to be happy where you are, but that's also a defense mechanism to be happy where you are. And listen, being open to the voice of another, it's receptivity. But listen, when I'm addressed by a religious tradition or I'm addressed by an intellectual tradition, it may make some demands upon me as well. I mean, I have to be open to the possibility of changing myself. And that requires a kind of – listen, why are people not religious these
days? I want to go back. Let me stop you. You said something interesting. Now, we'll see where it goes. Somebody says – you call him up. He says, I'm happy where I am. Now, that can be a defense. What does that mean? Because it's going to be it's a lot of work to start changing your job, thinking about the uncertainty of moving somewhere else. Is that what you're referring to?
I think we kind of all have a fear of discovery of possibilities of who we might become. I mean, I live in a neighborhood, you referred to it several times, and there really is, you know, a real kind of fear, a kind of giving in to the stories that other people are already telling about me. And I think a lot of my book is about storytelling, you know, and I think that has a lot to do with what people do everybody is telling a story about themselves. And if you're going to go into a job interview or to a recruiting interview, you have to tell a story. Now, some people, and a lot of people in religious communities, really, and this is what you're referring to, they take the stories that other people tell and they internalize them. That's one extreme. The other extreme is where I just say, you know, I'm writing my own story all by myself. And what I'm really suggesting is that there's some place in the middle. that I've got to be receptive to the stories that other people may be telling about me, or the place that I'm
You know
in.
What? Let me stop you. Let me stop you. I thought you were going to tell me if I call someone up and they tell me, hey, I'm happy where I am, you were going to give me an idea as to what I could tell to sort of dislodge them and make them be not so happy where they are,
well, I
or
imagine,
willing
you know,
to explore
you probably,
something.
You probably have better sense than I do. I don't know how to motivate.
No, I don't.
I don't know.
But
I mean, listen, you know, sometimes that it means really kind of entering into a relationship with a person and finding out what's motivating them. I mean, maybe
okay, I'm going to talk about relationships. I'm going to try to make the show a little practical, and then I'll open it up to questions. Okay. So here's your repeated thing. We are scared to death of uncertainty. We want to know the future is not a disaster. So we pretend to know what's out there, and we go into battle with anybody who criticizes what we believe. You say the habitual way, sort of the habitual way of seeing things is arrogant, and instead a person should always be soft like a reed, not hard like cedar. So you're saying that when we are, you know, saying that we know something, we're very certain, it's actually just an arrogant defense against, you know, not knowing where we're headed. So I'm thinking that in the recruiting context, and you can tell me if I'm right about that. Mm. So let's say I put a recruiting process into place. I have my own technique of recruiting people. And one of them is to get the candidate to tell me how much you're looking for. You know, is it 100, 75, whatever, right off the bat. And this guy has his own ideas, or girl, and they say, well, why am I going to spill my guts about what I want? I want to keep that close to my chest, and when they finally see how great I am, I'll be in a negotiating position, and I won't be stuck with whatever I said before. I actually even saw the company. So I can either say to this person, look, you do it my way or you're out, and I might be missing a good candidate. Is that the kind of stubbornness that you're talking about, the hardness as opposed to the flexibility?
Well, you know, my sense is that you really know what you're doing, and my guess is you're not going to do. You're not going to be all or nothing. You're going to try to find a way of getting into the mind of that person to find out what it is that they might want. I mean, I think an all or nothing mentality always loses.
What do you mean an all or nothing mentality? My way or the highway? Is that what you're talking about?
My way or the highway. I mean, does that work with you?
Well, it works with lots of recruiters. If you won't do things their way, yeah, they say, I don't want to deal with you.
And they miss out. And they probably miss out on candidates that are excellent, no?
Okay, maybe. Anyway, you also say union is achieved through well, let me ask it. Does anybody have a question for Bill? Go ahead. If anybody wants, Janice, anybody else, I don't think I'm bringing it to you properly. Go ahead.
Well, I have a question. Don't you believe that part of the reason, I understand where you're coming from in some of this, don't you believe, Bill, that part of the reason that people are afraid to venture into territory that they have not ventured into before is the times? Survival, we're in survival mode, okay, in everything on Earth right now, everything. And this is not the time, in my opinion, to say, hey, if you are afraid to venture out and do something that you're not a success in doing, then you're arrogant or you're a failure.
No,
he's not telling you to be reckless. Yeah. I mean, but he's not telling you to be reckless. But, Janice, that kind of – I'm answering for you, Billy. You'll get a chance. Don't worry. That kind of answer comes during good times as well. I'm afraid to make a move. Or not I'm afraid.
Right.
I'm happy where I am.
And that's human nature.
Bill,
you know, Janice,
Billy,
I understand your caution, and I'm not claiming that anybody's arrogant. You know, I was listening to somebody about social media,
mm-hmm.
and they were saying that, you know, in social media you have to be authentic. You ever heard that before, Animal? And I was thinking, you know,
go on.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you know, as much as I believe in authenticity, there is also a sense that, you know, you kind of become who you are through taking on certain roles. There was once a 19th century English writer, and he said, you know, you become who you are through putting on a mask. And I think there's a kind of profundity in that you've got to kind of experiment with different voices and try different perspectives. You know, I'm speaking really personally. I've done a lot of things in my life, and it does require risk. And I'm not suggesting, Janice, believe me, you know, you got to hold on to the persona, or you've got to hold on to that personality that's, you know, bringing home the money and you know, letting you put food on the table. But there is some sense, I think, where you have to try to risk becoming somebody else. I mean, Adam, you said, you know, part of me is Billy, and that's really right. I mean, part of me is who I was when I was a seventh grader, and that maybe is a lot of the energy of who I am now as an English professor. And I'm looking for other voices and other possibilities in order to, you know, realize myself more fully. I mean, I think there's always a kind of balance between that risk-taking.
Yeah, yeah,
and
okay, you're getting crazy.
I have a question. Question.
Stop. You say in your book, you make reference, you know, he's a specialist. This guy's a specialist in John Milton. I don't know if everybody knows.
John
very
who?
Famous,
John who?
Yeah, okay. He's a very famous English poet, and he's very religious, but he's also he's a famous liberal philosopher, I'd say, or exponent of liberalism, and you refer to his Puritan commitment to the authenticity of the individual. What are you talking about when you reference that?
I don't know.
That's why I'm asking. Come on.
Well, first of all, Milton's not a liberal, but let's not go there. I mean, Milton was a committed Christian and not a liberal. I mean, I think you were about to call me a liberal, and you told me there would be no name calling.
But hold on. What's Areopagitica all about? Isn't it the belief in the whole thing? You go on. You answer. I'm not going to talk right now. Go ahead.
So Milton has a very, very, very strong sense of self, and he's committed to himself, and he's committed to a world in which individuals realize themselves by really being in relationship to other people. I mean, it's two things, really. I mean, the reason that Milton is not a liberal, I mean, this is one of the things that I think is really interesting about our moment and Milton's moment. Animal, you talked about a pamphlet that he wrote in the 17th century against censorship. But Milton really wasn't a liberal. He didn't like Jews, and he didn't like Catholics, and he didn't like a whole bunch of different people. I mean, Milton was interested in creating a community in which people could be different, but it was also a community in which people could relate one to another. So I don't know how much Milton is really an intellectual ancestor of us, of ours as a liberal. But he did believe very, very powerfully in the self, very, very powerfully. And he also understood the dangers of that belief. I mean, the greatest individual in Western literature is Satan in Paradise Lost. And Milton has a kind of ambiguous relationship to him. But, you know, one of the things, my connection to Milton is that he does have this powerful commitment, I guess, to authenticity. But that authenticity, I think, again, we run into the realm of maybe contradiction or paradox, is authenticity sometimes realizes itself through taking on a role, through trying something new, through playing around a little bit. Jonas, that's really what I was referring to before. Having the guts to play, because discovery and invention happens through playing.
When you're speaking, I hear that you feel some sort of tension or conflict between people being who they are and, you know, thinking that they can succeed. I don't really, I guess in my personal life, I don't really feel that conflict, and I wonder if that's something that is universal.
So can you just say a little bit more about what you mean? I mean, I don't mean to be. I mean, listen. I think success is what we're all aiming for in some sense, and I think the most successful person though is not all the time thinking about how they look or appear to others in their success, and there still is that possibility of being receptive. I think the most successful people, in a way, are not all the time thinking about success. If I could just mention something again from a very, very Jewish context. You know, Jews are commanded, they're given various laws. They're called mitzvot. And the sages of the Talmud say you never know the reward for a particular mitzvah. You don't know what you're going to get from it. Now, some people do things because they think, I'm going to do this now, I'm going to do X, and I'm going to get Y. And I think, you know, ironically, the people who think least about reward and throw themselves most into what they're doing are the most successful. There's a poet, Auden, of the last century, and he speaks about these kinds of people who are successful. He says that they wear the same rapt expression for getting themselves in a function. That is, people who are successful are about doing. They're not about appearing to others in their success. They get lost in the joy, really that was the term you used before, Animal, of what they're doing. And I think that I'm not saying we shouldn't strive for success, but sometimes when we put that goal too much out in front of us, it prevents us from realizing it.
What intrigues me about you is this. your diatribe about going out of the box, being more than you have been, and the reason to do it, and your faith, okay? And where in this discussion are we connecting the two?
Mm. You know, Animal mentioned briefly, and I'll just go back, you know, he talked about my great-grandfather, Velvel, mm-hmm. and I'm named after him. You know, and I found this memorial book. He was killed in the Holocaust. And, you know, in the 60s and 70s in Israel, they started to publish mostly in Hebrew and Yiddish these testimonies about towns that had been destroyed. And there are hundreds of thousands of these books. And I found one in my aunt's attic. And, you know, there was a whole section on this guy, my great-grandfather, who we knew nothing about. And, you know, as Animal said, he was, you know, a Hasidic Jew with the long whole, you know, peyot, the payas, and the hat, the whole deal. And so here he was a person of faith. And when I speak about faith, I don't like these terms. It's really about connecting. It's connecting to a past, connecting to a tradition, connecting to community. So he was all of these things. But still, they said, you know, he was the most tolerant guy. He was the most tolerant person. And I think that's, I don't know what it's, I mean, I haven't really lived in the States for a while. I lived in Israel for the past 20 years. But I think the same dynamic happens here as in the state, as in Israel, that you have people who are tolerant, and you have people who are faithful. And the reason I start my book off with Velvel is because he's a model for me. You know, we talk about beginnings because we're really thinking about our present. The way we think about the past is the way we're really telling the story of who we are now and, more importantly, who we want to become. And that's why I started my book with my great-grandfather, because he embodies these two things. And I think, Janice, they actually can come together. You know, we live in a world of fundamentalism. I would say not only a fundamentalist religion, but a fundamentalist atheism. And they're like two sides of the same coin. And we should try to find some kind of way in which we can have belief, and we can also entertain complexity. We can also experience difference.
I agree.
Okay. I'm back, okay? I was off. I was bounced off.
I can't believe it. You know, I've heard your other
must
shows.
Must have been mystical. Must have been mystical, but you don't believe in mysticism, it strikes me. These people who want to be united with God, you're against that, right?
You're not going to find a picture of me in the newspaper picketing a mystic's house. You know, I mean, I'm not against them. But, you know, we talked a little bit about what holiness is, or, you know, and holiness in for me, and I think for the Jewish tradition that I understand, isn't some kind of like mystical state or of contemplation. Holiness is realized through action. It's in this world. You know, there's a verse in Deuteronomy. It says it's not in heaven, and holiness is not in heaven. It's in this world. I mean, I don't know how much, you know, homiletic liberty you want to give me here. But, you know, in Exodus, when it describes Moses' coming of age, it's a kind of coming of age novel of Moses in Exodus, it says that he went out and he saw the sufferings of his brothers. He went out and he saw them. He turned to see their suffering. So the first thing you see is what defines the growing up of the greatest prophet in the Jewish tradition is going out into a community and feeling the suffering of other people. And then later on it says that Moses saw the burning bush, and he turned to see the bush. And the sages, again, of the Talmud say, the reason that Moses saw the burning bush was because he turned to see the sufferings of his brethren. He turned to see the sufferings of his brethren, and therefore when he turned to see the burning bush, God was present. Which is
he was a community organizer.
Pardon?
He was a community organizer.
Well, yeah, I mean,
that's a big part of adulthood. Come on.
I hate that term.
Okay, listen, okay. It's your turn.
Yeah,
I mean,
I could finish.
You know, like, you know, we talk a lot in our culture about, you know, sacred spaces. You don't build a sacred space through contemplation. You build a sacred space through making yourself present to others.
I don't know if your great grandfather would have agreed with you that he came from obviously a different tradition than the one you're following right now. But I'm not sure about that, Animal, but I don't think so.
I mean,
he came from a mythical tradition.
Talking about is a concept of Tikkun Olam, right? Which is a fairly liberal Jewish tradition. It's not talked about very much in the hardcore Orthodox
Holmes. The hardcore, you know, I don't, listen, I'm, the last thing I want to do is come on this show and be defensive about orthodoxy or one version of Judaism over another. I'm not into that at all. But listen, Tikkun Olam has a very ancient pedigree. And there really were just Jews. There weren't denominations up until about 200 or 300 years ago. Tikkun Olam exists in the oldest of Jewish.
Yeah,
pedigree.
Nobody else except you and Dave Manister knows what Tikkun Olam is. So
I'm
why
sorry,
don't you
Dave,
explain
Tikkun
it?
Tikkun Olam means the rectification of the world. It means fixing the world. It means going out into the world, you know, and just seeing, you know, Janice, you were saying earlier, these are hard times. I mean, you know, these are harder times. But we're always faced with suffering. We're always facing loss. And the question,
you know what?
I think
let me shift this. I mean, this is like high, what I call high level talk. Okay, so
yeah.
Where was
I? Can lower it for you though. I got a question.
Great.
All right. Where
no one's going to lower it as much as me. I got a good question.
All right,
but I'll let you lower it first.
That's true.
Go ahead, Janice.
All right. What do you see to be the parallels today between faith and the suffering that people, quote-unquote suffering, that people are going through because of the uncertainty of the times? Do you see an increase in people becoming more observant, religious, faithful, whatever you want to call it?
Right. I don't know. I mean, those are good questions sociologically. Like, you know, in Israel also, people are suffering hard times, and people tend to become more faithful. I don't have a faith barometer or a faith thermometer, so I don't really know, you know, what's going on inside of people's heads.
But you can look. Well, you can look at it by synagogue or church attendance or mosque attendance. You can see.
Yeah, could be. And maybe some of those reasons are good. Sometimes I look around at people and I think sociologically there are a lot of bad reasons that people are becoming religious. I mean, religion more than anything can be a form of avoidance. What's a bad reason to avoid my problems? You know, a bad reason
How does that happen?
How does it happen that well, you know, people can really abandon, you know, the demands of the self by using religion as a crutch. Listen, you know, Freud was the first. I mean, I like psychoanalysis, but Freud was the first person who said that, you know, religion can become into a kind of obsessive avoidance of, you know, what really matters.
Well, give me a concrete example.
Your classic jailhouse conversion. You're in a place where it's just awful, it's terrible, and you embrace something to escape it.
Yeah, I mean, that's good.
There are no atheists in the foxholes.
Yeah, how's that a loss of the demands of the self? I mean, you might be adopting a fantasy that, you know, there's this light at the end of the tunnel, but how's that abandoning the demands of the self, which
well,
is
listen,
what
if
you
I,
said?
I don't want to trash, you know, my co-religionists or people from other religions, but, you know, if it's all about an external observance, and sometimes it can just be that, then, you know, we get back to what I spoke to before about.
You're changing the topic because we were talking, you know, we were talking about taking on the forms of religion. And just like Dave before, you were talking about taking on the forms of success. You're not against success, but you tell a story in your book. It's quite striking. Your daughters were taking dance classes, and they were just practicing on their own, playing around in the living room. Well, when they saw you were watching them, they tried to spruce up their performance. And you felt bad because they limited their creativity to make it look like it was a finished product.
There
and,
you go. And
that,
I kind of caught them in the act, and I felt bad, as you said. I mean, you know, I tell my kids sometimes when they go on these field trips, I say, do me a favor. Don't take your camera. Because if you're going to take your camera, you're not going to experience it. You're just going to, like, live the whole thing through the photographs that you take.
Oh, please, give me a break.
I think what he's saying is don't care what the other guy thinks. Don't make that more important than your mission.
Listen, we always
care
what other people think. But, you know, if the question is when I start to perform my religiosity, and that's what gives me, you know, solace, is how I look to other people. I mean, I guess you're what do you say, John?
Yeah, I don't think that's what the jailhouse conversion is, and I don't think that's what you were talking about. You're evading the question, so I'll move it down. I told you, I'm going to take it down to a very concrete low level.
First of all, I wasn't evading the question.
You didn't think you were, but you were, okay?
All right, take it down.
I was listening with my free-floating attention, and I caught that. You'll see it later on. Okay, Deuteronomy 25:12. Okay, or 11 and 12. It says that if two guys are fighting and the woman, the wife of one of them, grabs the testicles of the enemy of her husband in order to help her husband, that you're supposed to cut off her hand and show no mercy. What is it when an intelligent person reads that God said this? What's that supposed to mean?
Animal, it really, you know, first of all, I admire you on your very broad and deep knowledge of the five books of Moses.
Thank you. Don't
it's
even
really
the question. Answer
you,
it.
And that passage just screams out at me as well. Listen, I thought Animal's certainly going to ask me a question like that. I didn't think you were going to get testicles into the question. And listen, there are parts of my tradition that I have questions about. I've been involved in my tradition for like 20 years. Some of the questions I've answered, and some I haven't. I don't think anybody in the Jewish world, Orthodox or any other, is advocating the chopping off of women's hands these days. So it's
no
certainly
mercy.
Practically went.
And showing no mercy. That's so cruel. And the thing is, I've read once, if you really want to understand something.
That translation was the King James you're working with, just so I know I can check it later.
You're bad, Bill.
Prior to
20 years, were you born Jewish? Are you a
yeah.
convert? You were born Jewish. You just became more observant and faithful.
Right.
Okay.
Now, the thing is, hold on. You're making yourself sound very modest, but you dismiss Christopher Hitchens and those other atheists as being,
yuck.
You know, arrogant. And James Kugel, a religious guy, wrote a book explaining how the scientific analysis or the what's a critical analysis of the Bible, how it was written by different people and
biblical,
you know, patched together.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, you dismiss that as irrelevant. You know, you say these guys are just afraid of paradox. They've got a tin ear. You're pretty arrogant, if you ask me. And here's the stuff. Oh, yeah, I just, you know, I ignore that part. I say tea kettle when I get to those verses and just move on.
I think I would have preferred if you called me a liberal a little bit earlier.
I've got to tell you, if you would have answered my other questions more clearly, I wouldn't have come to this, because I think you say a lot of things in your book that tell us about how to relate to other people, about how, you know, don't be stubborn. I tried to, because your claim is that when you're stubborn in relation to other people, you're really just hiding a fear of your own. I thought you were going to expand on it, but you didn't. That's what here's something I told you to prepare. You talk about projection. When we don't like something about ourselves.
I haven't been told to prepare things since I've been in high school. I'm a professor now, so I didn't pay attention sufficiently.
Okay, well, listen, projection, that's a Freudian term.
Yeah.
Psychoanalysis, you like to refer to the psychoanalyst right through your book. I read the book. And so projection, I said, you know what, I've never heard anybody explain that properly. I'd like you to come with a few examples. You must remember me telling you that, and so that's what I want to hear. And projection is when we don't like something in ourselves. We find it unacceptable.
Right.
We forget it. We're totally unaware of it, but we see it in somebody else. I don't understand how that works. You want to explain it? Give me some examples.
I think you have as good a sense of this stuff as I do. But
No, I don't.
Okay, I'm answering, okay? I think sometimes instead of dealing with ambivalences that we feel, we externalize it in hostility to other people. Let me give you an example. My daughter, who just got married, she's 21. She was
very pretty girl. Hey, I saw the picture this morning.
Thank
she's
you.
Very attractive.
So a few years ago, in my community, there's a very big emphasis on modesty. Girls dress, you know, elegantly, but modestly. At one point, a man in the community came up to her and said to her that he scolded her for the way she was dressing. Now, it seems to me that a person like that is dealing with some kind of unresolved ambivalence, that he feels certain kinds of attractions that he can't deal with, and he projects that externally onto somebody else. He externalizes that ambivalence in himself. I'm attracted to certain people, I'm attracted to certain ideas, which I can't come to terms with. And therefore, when I see it outside of myself, I project my own ambivalence onto that person.
I would have referred back to that Deuteronomy advice.
Another example is I have a son with Down syndrome. He's 8 years old. And a lot of people can't really deal with that. And I think the people can't deal with that is because they're projecting their own ambivalence about themselves, because they want to feel entirely competent, entirely intelligent. And when they see a child who can't do things, there's a sense in which they project their own ambivalence.
Is that pure speculation on your part? I don't understand.
You know, we talked before about, you know, being soft like a reed and being receptive to people around you and not to use categories that are hard and fast. And I think when you use categories that are hard and fast, you'd stop seeing things around you. You know, I can't.
You know
really
what? I was reading something about when I was a little kid. I remember I went to visit my great grandmother.
Yeah.
And in the old people, they just different. They don't look like young people, and it was kind of sometimes uncomfortable. I think if I remember way back.
You know what? They haven't always been old. They were once young like us. You know.
Yeah. Well, when I'm 3 or 4 years old or five, you know, I don't have the brains to think of that. So somebody coming to your son, who sounds like a nice kid based on a lot of the things you said, they just might find that kind of person strange, and it might not be, you know, some projection of their inner conflicts. I think you're assuming that. I think you're making that up, and you're not listening with free-floating attention. I could be wrong, although you do say a number of things. You live in a religious community, and you found the people to be spineless and narrow-minded many times. The principal of the school you wanted to put your son in, he said, sure, we'll take him. And then he must have talked to other people, and he came back, and he was hemming and hawing, and there's other things I have to think of. He's the principal of a school. I assume he's well-educated in his religion. Am I right or wrong about that?
Yeah, well, sometimes there's a disparity. And, you know, we were talking about this in a professional context as well. There's a disparity between, you know, who we are or what our ideal about ourselves are and you know, how we actually act. And I think, you know, that disparity can be very, very discouraging for us. And it can be very discouraging on a personal level when we can't realize the ideals about ourselves in a personal way.
Okay, now you mentioned in the book, all of a sudden when you came back to him and he was trying to get rid of you, he started calling you rabbi. Not professor.
Yeah, I love that.
You're not a rabbi. And you said that was a bad sign. Is that something going on there, subconscious? What was happening?
Well, I just think he was trying to throw me a couple of bones and, you know, call me Rabbi Carl Brenner.
Oh, I see. Okay. Anybody else want to talk?
It's like when you're trying to, like, get rid of somebody and you call them, sir.
Yeah.
Sir, I can't really help you right now.
Okay. Anybody else? There's a number of people here. Anybody's free to talk about anything?
I think what he's saying, and I need to
one sec. I just want to see if there's anybody besides David Janice.
Cool.
I don't mind David Janice. You're both very bright. But is there anybody else who wants to say something? You don't have to be Jewish. It just happened that he comes from the Jewish religion. I said I'm never going to talk about religion on the show, and I end up with this guy. So if anybody wants to say
this
anything, they're welcome.
You might want to call me rabbi instead of this guy. Jeez, animal.
Well, hold on. Come on. Your specialist is a Puritan. It made me think of William Penn. He wouldn't take his hat off for anybody. Those guys didn't have respect for positional authority,
Animal, I am taking my hat off for you as we speak.
Okay, is that like calling me rabbi? Anyway, Janice, here's your chance. Nobody wanted to come forward. Go ahead. Janice is exec job coach on Twitter, worthingtoncareers.com. Go ahead.
Okay, what is your main message? What do you want to leave your listeners with? Because we're getting off on all these different things, all of which I'm very interested in. Okay, we come from a similar background. But for your listeners in today's world, what's the most important message you feel you can leave them with?
That's such a good question, Janice. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, part
of... He just called you rabbi, by the way.
Oh, Animal, give me a break over here, all right? I mean, I think part of the problem with, you know, my trying to get my message or messages across is I think, you know... Some things can't be diluted into a soundbite. And I think probably part of my message is really what I said earlier, is that we can have appreciation for difference and otherness and pluralism and still be committed people. I mean, but I would suggest that I have different messages in different kinds of contexts and frameworks. And my book is about a whole lot of different kinds of things. It's
you know what?
Faith.
You've got
it's
one
about...
big message. You've got one big message, and I'm going to tell everybody what it is now, and you can
is
sort of...
Is going to help me sell books or not going to help me sell books?
We should mention your book. Although,
Open
you
Mind
know, Detail,
which is
tell
also
you.
Available on Amazon in the U.S. for $13. But go ahead.
$10.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the hard copy. Okay.
Hard copy.
But it's called... He is on Twitter. He's Om Torah. It sounds more like a Hindu kind of thing.
Torah. Open-minded Torah, yeah.
O-M-T-O-R-E. A-H?
Right. I've got all these social media people, career people, recruiters following
you now. Yeah, well, they might not after the show.
It's okay. I'll
Trust me on that. Okay, so here's what was I going to say? Okay, now you say something nice. You say God wants all of you. God wants all the sort of the parts of you that you don't like or whatever to serve Him or to be present. Just let me look about your whole thing is denying weakness. That's one of your fundamental ideas, that we are have to deny weakness, and that you want and the way to God requires honesty about your desires, even if they are for things which are forbidden. We are not scandalized by our desires. To deny them leads to split personalities and mental illness. We make these things part of our service to God. We're allowed to be whole people, even if we're not allowed to do everything and act everything out. If we lie about our feelings, we're conformists. That's sort of what you're trying to say. Deny our deliberate separateness. And anyway, so God wants the whole person. That's what you're saying. How do you bring that whole person out?
It's like Bill and Billy and William and Zev. It's and Velvo, all my different names. I mean, we're hybrid personalities, and we have a lot of energies from a lot of places, and I think a dangerous thing, and a lot of people who do what the jailhouse conversion is to say, you know what, that person how I used to be doesn't exist anymore. And I think that's a recipe for failure on a religious level, certainly on a psychological, on a personal level. That really the success will be is taking the parts of me, even that I might be slightly embarrassed about, and integrating them. Because if I don't, that part of me is going to come back and get me.
How? How do you integrate? I've asked you lots of how questions. You didn't tell me how to make a cold call. I thought that's the least thing you're going to do.
Listen, I can analyze a sonnet by Shakespeare. I don't make cold calls. That's your business. How do you do it?
You talk endlessly about communication and relating to strangers and difference. And come on, I'm giving you a fantastic opportunity to say, the religious guide to cold calls. You could sell a million books if you want to write a book like that. I'll write it with you. But you're just denying it every time I'm giving you a break. Here's an easy one for the masses. You believe in dreams. You say dreams come from the innermost thoughts of the heart. Dreams bring these thoughts into awareness. You want to talk about that a bit? Why do you believe in dreams, significance of dreams?
Well, I mean, dreams is, the sages of the Talmud say when a dream comes, you have to answer it. It's like a letter that you have to open up. I mean, there's a part of your soul, there's a part of your psyche that's speaking to you. And we are very tempted, I think, to ignore the message, not to open it. Maybe the message is too painful. Maybe the message is too embarrassing. But there are all sorts of ways in which we have to try to, the how is, how do I become an integrated personality? A lot of people become religious in my community. They're taking drugs, listening to Led Zeppelin and doing a whole lot of other stuff. The religious life, as you said, doesn't incorporate all of that. It may incorporate still listening to Zeppelin. It may incorporate using all those energies, but in some kind of other framework. I mean, it means really acknowledging who I am and finding those energies and using them in a positive way. I mean, the worst thing that you can do is say, I'm now going to be a good person. And being a good person means I have to abandon the person who I once was. Because once I do that, I'm abandoning who I am. So the how is being honest about what my desires are. Did I answer your question, Adam, or I lost you someplace?
That's my best sound clip for the show when I start cutting things up. But you say when we want the dream filled with dread to undergo a transformation, you transform a curse through love into a blessing. What does that mean?
Well, I think it goes back to what Janice was talking about. I mean, we experience suffering and we experience loss and we experience dread. And the question is, how do we deal with that loss? I mean, my students ask me when I teach Western literature, I teach Homer and Aeschylus and Sophocles, and every one of those books is about suffering. They say, why are we reading all this depressing stuff? And I always tell them, because life is characterized by suffering. And the question that we have to answer is, how do we address that? When we feel loss, how do we deal with it? Do we ignore it? Because if we ignore it, forget it. We run away from it. Question is, and this is what your other listener talked about, Tikkun Olam, rectifying the world. When I feel or address something that doesn't make sense about part of my personality, or there's some kind of suffering that I'm experiencing, well, how do I move forward to it from it? How do I integrate it into the story that I want to tell about myself? It's got to be part of my story. Again, I think...
Okay, and then let me move on. So you also said cultivating a voice. My book is about cultivating my voice,
right,
and helping others cultivate their own voices. That's, mm-hmm, if Janice, if that's a message, want to tell us what that means?
Well, let me just...
No, Janice,
tell you.
I didn't say Janice would tell us. I said he would tell you.
Okay.
I'm interested in what Janice says.
Because I have
say,
one more
yeah.
thing before you're done.
Yeah.
Okay, Janice, go ahead, because we have 5 minutes left, but I want that cultivating a voice answer. Go ahead, Janice.
I'm a coach, and here's how we deal with the suffering with our people, those who are believers in any God of all. Okay, and I learned this from one of my sons. When people feel bad about who they are, and they feel that like they're failures, and they feel like things aren't going well for them because they're stupid or they've done something bad, we tell them, God doesn't think of you that way. God doesn't look at you that way. The boss might have, the coworker might have, your wife might have, but God doesn't see you that way.
Right.
That,
I mean,
that tends to put things in perspective.
We very often get so lost in the conversations that other people are having about us, or in the assumptions that other people are having about us, that we lose that internal voice. And I also think in our generation that it's very easy, and again, this is my interest in psychology, it's very easy to lose contact with what is authentic to me.
You know what, Bill, in your book you say almost nothing about what you get out of religion. That was actually the second thing I was going to ask you, but I wanted to go into this practical stuff. You say God doesn't, you never know how God's going to reward you. He's not going to take care of your life. You can't, meld yourself in with him. We just talked about that. You don't say, I mean, you make life sound like one of those Greek tragedies. You don't say what you get out of religion. It's not like what Janice is saying, oh, God loves you. Now, you do mention that joy. You do mention that there's, joy in through vulnerability, but what do you mean by cultivating a voice? Let's start with there. Then if we have a minute left, you can tell us what you get out of religion.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit. I mean, it is a book that's entitled Open-Minded Torah, not just being open-minded. And, when you said that the rewards that we get are not so much future-oriented, but really present-oriented. That is living within the present and being able to tell a story about my present, which is not so dominated by these kind of false stories that everybody are telling about what success is or what happiness is, or as Janice mentioned, not going to the present because of my fear about it. I mean, we are always kind of putting off the present, and I think really a joyous, what you call religious life, is a life that's able to live in the present without this constant fear of what the future is. I mean, listen, part of telling stories is having a sense of a future, an ideal to which I'm tending. But it doesn't mean sometimes the stories that we tell are so overburdening that there's no place for the I. There's no place for my own voice. And you mentioned Milton's Paradise Lost, and I talk about in my book that in Paradise Lost, God is the author of all things. But for Milton, Adam and Eve are also authors to themselves. So we're kind of part of this story in which God is telling a story, but we're also writing our own stories. I think that's that authenticity, is being able to write my own story.
Did anybody think he answered my question? I'm going to become confused. I don't know what you get out of being religious. I assume it's something because you are committed, and you sound like an intelligent guy, and I respect the fact that you're still who you used to be as well. You're a regular American. I can hear it. That I can relate to you.
Since of all the things you've said to me, I guess I'll take that as a compliment.
I also thought it was funny. I also thought it was funny that you were listening when you're in Jerusalem. You were listening to W Fan, and the Mets had a big game on, and they were talking about it. But you didn't call in because you didn't want to have to say it's Bill from Jerusalem. I thought that was pretty funny. Last thing, you warn people that if the Mets have a big win one night, don't get too excited because there's a whole season, and that's one thing about baseball. It's so long a season that one victory or one defeat don't mean that much. I think that's a profound lesson.
And my answer would be a little bit ambitious from a recruiting point of view. I think it has references for that kind of thing as well. I mean, I can't generalize out of any one experience, whether a success or a failure, into the future. We often do that. again, we have to kind of live in the present. Because if I generalize from a particular experience, I'm not going to go forward. It's a long season, right? And so are the lives that, you know, we're living. And we can't postpone we can't not live in the present because of a sense of...
Yeah, you know what? You're garbling it up. I gave you a good intro there. You clearly said in your book, just if you have a bad interview, that's not the whole world. The whole world has not gone down. You
that's
got another
right.
another
Thank
few
you for quoting
games
me
in advance.
My, yes.
Excellent.
I will, okay.
We call
okay.
it that
now,
today.
Now, there's only about six people on the line. Jerry's not here. I was not going to have an after show. Is anybody really in need of an after show to decompress after this one? I don't think so. Am I wrong? I'll listen to what people... I've got my...
I wouldn't mind keeping the guest around for a bit if you want to. It's up to you, but I'll.
You
want to
stay on a little longer, Bill?
I can stay on for another 5 or 10. Sure.
Cool.
As long as you don't attack
okay.
me anymore,
Janice,
Animal, then I'll be good. I'll stay on as long as you want.
Janice, go ahead. You obviously had something you want to ask.
Well, no, I just wanted to say we're very much aligned, and this can be aligned toward careers and toward job search and toward recruiting, because if something bad happens to you and the phone gets slammed down on you, you look in the mirror and you go, hey, that's today.
Right. Right.
Thank God, there's probably going to be a tomorrow.
Right. Listen, there's always another at bat. I think baseball's, you know, a very fertile set of metaphors for that. You know, you strike out once, you know, and it's also baseball's great because, you know, what is a successful baseball player? He gets a hit 3 out of 10 times. That's
right.
You know, not so great.
And there are too many
people. Something else.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. No. Here's something else that he did. Again, a fundamental idea that Bill's got in his book that I found interesting. He says learning from one teacher might show loyalty and it might give you some kind of public image by associating yourself with someone famous, but you're limiting your thinking because you're not exposing yourself to diverse ideas. I like that. I really respect it. And I was once studying meditation with, I think it was a Taoist tradition, and one of the guys there told me, a Chinese guy, he said, well, you know, somebody told me that my practice is not that good because I've studied with too many teachers. And that's the exact opposite. So I like Bill's version better.
I mean, again, you know, I like both versions. You know, I mean, there's an injunction in the sages of the Talmud say you have to have a rabbi, you have to have a teacher, you have to have somebody you can go to. But if you're going to that teacher just because of his reputation, you like his affiliation, you like his club, that's not going to work. And I think especially in the world we live in, you know, we have part of many, many different kinds of conversations.
Our secular world calls them mentors, and when you find one that really teaches and fulfills you, it's tough to abandon them, and there's an interesting word for somebody else. But it's good to get exposure to many successful people and many people that can enlighten you.
Right. I would just say a couple of things. You know, the sages also say, the Talmud, you know, who is wise, a person who learns from all people. And really the measure of wisdom is seeing that you have a desire to learn from everybody. It may mean that, you know, you have a mentor. But I think one of the things that I want to go back to, and you know, Animal, you keep on talking about my emphasis on vulnerability. I mean, you know, you would, I don't know if you've ever gone into a traditional yeshiva seminary context, but you would like it because, first of all, everybody's screaming all the time and you would fit right in. But you know, the thing about learning in yeshiva is that you're always learning with a study partner. And that's, you know, for a couple of reasons. One is it's a great way of studying a complex text. But the other is that the faces of the text only come out through the faces of a person. And they're going to be different people are going to show different faces of the text. And I think, you know, Janice, we could generalize into it into another context, that we want different ways of looking at things. And we're parts of many conversations because those different conversations are nourishing for us on some psychological or spiritual level, but also because it's just the world is very complex, as you're suggesting, more so now than it ever was, and that we need different kinds of perspectives, different points of view in order to really extrapolate what's the truth. I mean, I wasn't trashing science, as you suggested, Animal, and I have, you know, great respect.
Okay, but we're going to stop now, Billy. It's William Cole Brenner, K-O-L-B-R-E-N-E-R, O-M-T-O-R-A on Twitter. Bill, what's your website?
It's O-M-T-R-A-H on Twitter. And on my website.
O-M-T-O-R-A-H. Poor visualization on my part. Sorry. What's your website?
And my website is openmindedtorah.com, and my book is of the same title, Open-Minded Torah of Irony, Fundamentalism and Love. It's published with Continuum. It's on Amazon.
Yeah, you said that leaders. You said that leaders are good joke tellers because they can see things through many, many different perspectives.
I don't
think that's true.
You don't think that's true?
Leaders don't have a good sense of irony, do they? Aren't they leaders because they're ready to commit to one point of view and you know, come what may.
Committing to one point of view doesn't make it impossible to see the possibility of other points of view.
And on that note, thank you, Billy!
Hey, Bill, nice to meet you.